Now, Christmas time, time when we think about food from time to time, and all sorts of fancy things are in the shops, aren't they? Have you come across these? You can get them kind of three bird, four bird, five bird roasts. Have you come across those? Have you ever had one of those? I think the kind of the big ones. It's kind of I don't know what it starts with. Does it start with a quail inside a chicken, inside a duck, inside a turkey, inside a goose? I think is the five one. And it's kind of, you know, seems bonkers to me. But you can buy a four bird roaster in Aldi now, you know, for £8 or something, and you can have a four bird roast if that kind of thing appeals to you. You know, food just kind of dominates the scene really at Christmas so much, doesn't it? And this afternoon, I actually want to think about not a turkey, not a goose, not a duck, not a quail, but I want to think about pigeons. Because pigeons are mentioned here in the reading we've had, and you might have been thinking, why on earth do we need to know that they had turtle doves and pigeons with them on this momentous occasion when Mary and Joseph took the baby Jesus, who was probably a couple of months old by this time, took him to the temple. Why? What's the pigeons all about? Pigeons are actually quite interesting creatures, if you think about it. I don't know if you ever kind of sat there, you know, lying in bed at night thinking about pigeons. Maybe you have, maybe you haven't. Homing pigeons, for instance, fascinating creatures. I mean, you know, they're a real kind of the, as you go north from here, very much a thing that people are very keen on in terms of training them and everything else. They're actually fascinating creatures. They can fly at speeds, apparently an average speed of about 40 miles an hour. They can navigate their way back to a fixed point across hundreds of miles over impassable terrain, if you will, trying to walk it. So good are they at doing that, and actually, even in these technological days that we're in now, they were actually used, apparently, during the Gulf War to send messages that otherwise might not have got through because of intense radio jamming in certain areas. It is astonishing, isn't it, when you think about it, especially as most of us could get lost just getting to the other side of Derby, and yet there's a pigeon who can find its way back from just about anywhere. How is it that an animal with a brain literally not much bigger than the size of a pea can actually do something like that? I suppose, though, most people's ideas of pigeons probably relate more to a kind of common pigeons that gather in places like Trafalgar Square and things like that, just about anywhere there's food. We had a very nice lunch with Pete and Pam today, and as we were looking out of the window, I commented that there was an extremely fat pigeon sitting on the fence there. You know, that's kind of the way we tend to see pigeons. They tend to be hanging around. I mean, they've got a lovely bird feeder just underneath the fence. I think the pigeon was waiting for another bird to come along and kind of drop some stuff on the floor so it could dive down and get it. Not that it looked like it needed much. We tend to think of them as annoying pests who can do real damage to buildings and the environment. When I was working as a surveyor, I had to go and inspect a building in the centre of London that had been... I mean, you wouldn't believe what the pigeons had done to it. I mean, they've just about destroyed the place. It was quite incredible. What possible use could a bird like that be? Why on earth were Mary and Joseph going to the temple with pigeons? Well, actually, I think we'll see, as we look at this passage, there's quite a lot to learn from pigeons here in the Bible. Have we got a problem with the sound? Do you want me to use that mic rather than this? No, you're okay. In verse 22, we read what's going on. Mary and Joseph are on their way to the temple. It's about 6 weeks, 6 or 8 weeks after the birth of Jesus. It's actually interesting in the Bible, isn't it, that we're told very, very little about the early years of Jesus, about his time growing up. We only really hear about Jesus from the age of about 30 onwards, and then we get kind of an intense three years worth. But before that, we hear very little. The other three Gospels have almost nothing about it. Here in Luke, we have what's in the second half of chapter 2 and not much else. And of all the things we might want to know about the growing up of Jesus, of all that happened up until he was the age of 30, all we have to go on are these two kind of strange little incidents in the temple that are recorded here in Luke chapter 2. And even then, some of the details that Luke tells us seem to be, at first reading, pretty mystifying, slightly confusing, really. Why are we told, as I've said, about there being two pigeons in verse 24? It sounds almost like a kind of a slightly boring day on the cricket commentary from Lord's, doesn't it, when they start talking about the birds in the outfield, or if you've listened to the test match commentary from India, they kept talking about the red kites that were circling around the field. Yeah, something to talk about when there's nothing else to talk about. common, ordinary scavenger birds. Rats with wings, some people call pigeons. But Mary and Joseph bring these two pigeons with them. When there must be so much that Luke could tell us about the growing up of Jesus, why does he take the time to tell us about a detail like two pigeons or turtle doves? Why? Well, I suppose we could first of all say that the pigeons are proof. The pigeons are proof that this is a genuine account. And this is an eyewitness account. I mean, who but an eyewitness is going to mention that they came along with a couple of pigeons? If you were making a story up or telling something you only vaguely knew secondhand, you're not going to put that sort of detail in, are you? But someone who could remember the scene, someone who could picture it vividly in their memory, could well have passed that information on to Luke as he researched for his book. I remember, yeah, they came there, two pigeons with them, you know. Or it may be also that Luke mentioned these pigeons to emphasise the humble situation of Jesus' birth. So just as we have pigeons and proof, we've got pigeons and poverty as well. You see, the law said that after a woman had given birth to a son, she must not go to the temple for a total of 41 days after the birth, because she was ritually unclean. And then she must go to the temple and sacrifice a lamb as a burnt offering. But if she couldn't afford a lamb, there was a hardship provision. Those who genuinely couldn't scrape enough together to pay for a sheep to sacrifice and were in extreme poverty could bring two pigeons instead. We read about that in Leviticus, chapter 12, I think it is. So you see, these pigeons, in a sense, are actually a mark of shame. Parents who want to do the best but can't afford to. I mean, like sending your child to school with no shoes and no lunch. It's like getting married in jeans and a t-shirt, not because you're trying to make a statement, but because you can't afford a wedding dress, no matter how much you'd like one. And Mary and Joseph are poor. They can't afford a lamb. So they bring the two pigeons that are allowed instead. Two pigeons in that culture of the day then, in this important event at the temple in the life of Jesus, say something very important about him. When the King of Heaven came into this world, it was no smooth, privileged ride, was it? He was not born with a silver spoon in his mouth, immune from life's hardships, unable to relate to the struggles that we go through. He was born to a couple who had to take the pauper's route for the sacrifice they brought to the temple. Pigeons are proof. Pigeons tell us about poverty. Pigeons, most importantly, tell us about a promise fulfilled. We look at verses 22 to 24. I wonder, just if you quickly look at those verses, what's the phrase or idea that keeps getting repeated in those verses? Does someone want to shout it out if you've spotted it? The Lord, Lord. Yeah, thank you, John T. Yeah. I was trying to avoid you. Never mind. the law of the Lord or the law of Moses is mentioned in those three verses, three times, isn't it? Once in each verse. And the point that's being made is they're obeying the law of the Lord, the law of Moses. They're acting according to the law. What Luke's doing then is directing us to the great longing of the Old Testament, that one day a Messiah or a rescuer would come. How's he doing that? Well, he's doing it by reminding us that the Old Testament speaks of him who will do what nobody else has ever done, to live a life of complete obedience to God's law. So what are we being told right at the start of Jesus' life? Before he, in a sense, physically is able to be obeying God's law, his parents are making sure that God's law is obeyed in his life. Look again at verse 22. When the time came for their purification according to the law of Moses. So Luke's making a point of telling us that Mary keeps the law's requirement of a time of purification after childbirth, as I mentioned earlier. Verse 22 goes on. They brought him up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. 23, as it is written in the law of the Lord, every male who first opens the womb shall be called holy to the Lord. Every firstborn male is to be consecrated to the Lord. That's a command we find in Exodus 13. And then they go on in verse 24 to offer a sacrifice according to what is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. And that's that provision in Leviticus 12 I mentioned before, for the poor is to sacrifice instead of a lamb. And again we read in verse 27 that they did what the law required according to the custom of the law. They brought him into the temple. Luke doesn't want us to miss the point, does he? Which is why he's hammering it home time and again. According to the law of Moses, as it's written in the law of the Lord, according to what it says in the law of the Lord, etc. The custom of the law. Again and again in the verses, what is important is God's law, God's law, God's law. And it's being obeyed. He wants us to notice it. In every detail of Jesus' life, from the very beginning in his parents' arms, his whole life will be lived perfectly keeping God's law. Isn't that astonishing? A life of total and perfect obedience to God. What you and I can't do, he did. What you and I can't do, Jesus came to do for us. Jesus, like no one else who's ever lived, would do what God says, even down to the seemingly nitpicking details of the law's requirements about times of circumcision and purification and the right sort of sacrifice. And then with his perfect life at the cross, at his death, he swaps with you and me, doesn't he? He'll take our disobedience and exchange, give us his perfect record of obedience from the moment he was born and before, in fact, to give it to us to be counted as our own in place of our sin. So that when God looks at you and me, he sees us not just as forgiven, but as people he's pleased with and delighted in, because he sees obedience, the obedience of Jesus transferred to us. Now, imagine for a minute that you were on the Titanic. And you found yourself on deck about to leap into the water, and you suddenly realised two things. First of all, you remember you can't swim. And secondly, there happens to be a huge lead weight strapped to your back. But then you notice that beside you on deck is, no, not Leonardo DiCaprio or Kate Winslet, but it so happens to be the Australian Olympic and world champion swimmer, Ian Thorpe. Do you remember him doing the commentaries on the Olympics this year? Ian Thorpe's there with a life jacket on. And just as the water comes up to your knees, he pulls off his life jacket and he puts it on you. And he unstraps your lead weight and puts it on his own back. And as you jump into the water and float up to the surface in the life jacket, you watch him disappear down into the depths, stinking like a stone to the bottom. Never had a chance. None of his Olympic medals are doing him any good now. That's the sort of swap that Jesus did for you and me at the cross. He not only took your burden and mine, our sin, on himself, our disobedience, our rebellion against God, he not only took on himself the punishment that we deserve for our sin, the punishment of death, but in its place he gave us his ticket to heaven, if you like, his life jacket, his perfect obedience that makes us acceptable to God in his presence. And Luke's letting us know that from the very beginning, that the rescuer that the Old Testament promised, that God's people have longed to see, has finally arrived. Actually, it's the pigeons that help point us to that. But it's not just pigeons that point us to that fact, to that truth. But Luke also shows us people, and through the people he shows us a promise fulfilled. So the pigeons have shown us a promise fulfilled, now the people are showing us a promise fulfilled. This Old Testament longing for God's kingdom has a human face. Here in the temple we meet two people who embody that Old Testament longing for this great Messiah to come. In two fascinating little encounters, we meet first a guy called Simeon and then an old lady called Anna. In verse 25, Luke describes Simeon the priest as someone who is waiting for the consolation of Israel. It's an interesting phrase, isn't it? It's not the sort of phrase you hear bandied around all the time. Simeon was waiting for the consolation of Israel. Not meaning that kind of he was waiting around and Israel was the consolation prize, you know, in the contest. He was waiting for Israel to be consoled in its sorrow because it was waiting for its rescue. He was waiting for the yearning of God's people to finally be met, for them to finally be comforted, for their groaning and longing for the Messiah to finally be satisfied. This was Simeon's great longing, and as the priest, he was doing it on behalf of the people as well as on his own behalf. And as Mary and Joseph arrive at the temple, imagine actually how creepy it could have felt for them. Here's an old man they've never met, a stranger who's been waiting for them. Imagine that. I've been waiting for you. And you're thinking, hang on a minute. In fact, he's been waiting many years for them to arrive. We're told in verse 26 that God had especially told Simeon that he wouldn't die until he had seen the Lord's Christ, the Messiah. Remarkably, he knows that this is that day. That moment he's been waiting for years, the moment God promised to him. This finally is the child that God so long ago promised to send, that Simeon has been longing to see for all this time, and suddenly, now at last, he's here. And in verse 29, Simeon, having taken the child Jesus into his arms, and to bless him according to the custom of the law, Simeon starts to speak, doesn't he? And says, Lord, now you are letting your servant depart in peace. Like someone desperately tired. Someone fighting off sleep to stay awake for something important. Simeon has determinedly clung to life for the privilege of seeing God's great salvation arrive. Imagine what it must be like waiting. Am I going to make it? I know God said so. Is it going to happen? This is the day he's dreamed of. Lord, take me now. I can die in peace. I've seen your salvation. You'd almost expect, wouldn't you, perhaps Simeon to kind of just wander off into a corner and curl up into a ball and just kind of drop off peacefully and contentedly to sleep. Never to wake again. He's seen it all at last. Oh, I can relax. But also, just as Mary and Joseph have been accosted by this possibly strange old priest talking about God now dismissing him or letting him depart, and as they marveled at what he said about their son, a strange old lady appears as well. And she calls out and she draws a crowd round Mary and Joseph. That's what we're told about in verse 36. This prophetess called Anna, advanced in years, she'd been, as a young woman, she'd married. She'd had 7 years of marriage with her husband before he died. And then she lived as a widow until she was 84. She never remarried. She instead spent the rest of her life, possibly 60 years or so, hanging around the temple, spending her time fasting and praying. Now, fasting was something you did when you were waiting for God to answer your prayer. Some people still fast and pray today. Some people find that helpful. But you fasted because you wanted God to answer your prayer. There was something you desperately wanted him to do. And you just want to focus your mind on that, because it was so important. I mean, I don't know about you, I guess most of us, if we pray for something, we might pray for it for maybe, you know, 2 or 3 days, 4 or 5 days, maybe a week, if it's kind of quite important. Maybe after a week or so, nothing happens, then we're quite tempted to give up. Oh, maybe I've been praying for the wrong thing. Maybe God isn't going to do that after all. Maybe if we're kind of really firing spiritually on all cylinders, we'll keep going for a fortnight or maybe a month. Really praying, because we're expecting God to act. But it's really hard to stick at it, isn't it, for a long time. But it seems that God, through Luke's writing here, wants us to understand that persistence in prayer really does matter. And here in the coming of Jesus, Anna's great prayer, her daily prayer for, think about it, 60 years. Quick burst of maths. About 20,000 days. The focus of her whole life has finally come to fruition. Her prayer has finally been answered. The event she's been longing for has finally happened. But what both Simeon and Anna have been waiting for is God's promised rescuer. The one who God had promised to send, his Messiah, his servant, his anointed king. And now he's finally arrived. And all that waiting, maybe with people chuckling a little bit in a corner behind their hands, oh, look, they're still at it, you know. And when they ever realise, you know, they're bonkers. They keep saying they're waiting for this to happen. Finally it has. Finally they're vindicated. Their wait is over. And with such a joyful result. You remember those Chilean miners who were trapped, I think it was thousands of feet, wasn't it, below ground in that mine in Chile because of a collapse? And how it took weeks to bore a tunnel through which they could be rescued. You remember watching those pictures as they came to the surface? Astonishing, wasn't it? Not a single one died. Imagine their feelings as they were trapped. Wondering if help would ever get there. Wondering if anyone would be able to find a way through before they ran out of food and everything else. And suddenly, you hear this grinding noise. And it gets louder and louder. And then you see the drill bit coming through. Followed by the bore pipe. And then you see the rescue capsule being lowered down. After all that waiting, all that wondering, all that longing for a rescue, finally the rescue has come. Isn't that how Simeon and Anna must have felt when they saw this baby being brought into the temple? Nothing special to look at, just a baby. But they knew, because God's Holy Spirit revealed it to them, that this was the one. Verse 30, Simeon says, "For my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in the presence of all peoples." He talks about God's salvation as something carefully prepared. God's been doing the groundwork for this moment for thousands of years, right through the Old Testament, right from the very beginning, Genesis 1:1 and before even. He's been preparing this salvation because he knows it's going to be necessary. And the thing we need saving or rescuing from, it isn't that we're trapped under a load of rubble in a mine in Chile. But something far, far worse. Simeon's wonder is that God is going to finally do something about sin. He's finally going to do something about the thing that stops us having a right relationship with God. He's finally going to do something that means that we can look to the future with confidence and certainty and joy and hope, because we will know that death is not the end, but just the beginning of something even more wonderful. Lord, you're letting your servant depart in peace because I've seen your salvation that you have been preparing all this time, that you promised in your word. That's what Simeon and Anna and we and everyone needs saving from, isn't it? Sin. Disobedience to God, and the one who can save us from it is the one who's perfectly obedient to God. Luke's no Agatha Christie. He's not leaving us waiting to the last page to see what happens, actually. Here at the time of Jesus' birth, Luke actually shows us how the story will end, what Jesus' death will be about. But picture the scene in the temple, if you can, where animal sacrifices for sins were made each day by the priest. Animals were being killed. There was a lot of noise.
They were being drained of blood. There was a smell, and they were being burnt. It wasn't a kind of clean and clinical place. Sacrifices made every day, because every day they were needed. Here Mary hands over Jesus to the priest, who takes him into his arms. And Simeon knows that at last has come the sacrificial lamb who will take away the sin of the world once and for all. The one perfect sacrifice that we'll be remembering in a minute as we share in bread and wine, remembering Christ's death for us. The one perfect sacrifice that all this temple and all its ceremonies and every sacrifice every day throughout the history of Israel has been, well, just a preparation for, just a pointer towards, just a pale shadow of the reality that is Christ. The appearing of his salvation, that is his son. But notice too that there is a dark side to Simeon's words. For this child will not be everyone's saviour. Simeon says in verse 34, "Behold, this child is appointed for the fall and rising of many in Israel, and for a sign that is opposed, and a sword will pierce through your own soul also, so that thoughts from many hearts may be revealed." The coming of Jesus isn't what everyone is longing for. He will divide people. Some will leave everything to follow him. And they'll be filled with joy, just like Simeon and Anna. But others will oppose him and speak against him and reject him. In Israel then and in the world today. Unlike Simeon and Anna, their hopes, their longings will be revealed to be in different things. They're putting their trust in things other than God and other than Jesus, his son. Their trust and hope is not in the coming of God's king at all. Jesus isn't the fulfillment of their dreams, but threatens to shatter their dreams because he shows them up to be, well, just froth, just of no significance. Which is why some then so desperately sought to kill him and have him crucified, and why now some so desperately want him to be marginalised and mocked and prevented from being mentioned. See, the fact is that we each have to decide, don't we, where we stand with Jesus. And Christmas is an important time, and not the only time when we should be doing that. I mean, there are lots of decisions to make at Christmas, aren't there? I hate shopping. And I can never decide what to buy people at Christmas. But thankfully, that is just something I have to worry about once a year. And I don't have to worry about it for many people, because Janice does most of the Christmas shopping, for which I'm very grateful. But there's one decision that doesn't go away with the end of the Christmas season. And it's the decision whether we will welcome Jesus or reject him. And actually, it's a decision that we need to make every day. Are we going to, if we've put our trust in Jesus, are we going to keep trusting him? Or are we going to give up on him? Are we going to get, a bit overconfident and think it doesn't matter anymore? Get a bit slapdash? Or are we, maybe we've never accepted him. Maybe we're just going to continue to reject him. It's not something that you can say, I've got nothing to do with. Each of us has to decide. Will we welcome Jesus like Simeon and Anna and recognize him for who he is and know that our hearts are filled with joy, that actually nothing else in life matters? As Simeon said, "Lord, I can depart in peace now. Nothing else matters. I've seen your salvation at last." Or are we going to reject him and say, "No, I'm going to stick with what I've got"? Can I just encourage us? We may think, "Oh, I know the Christmas story. Yes, I do trust Jesus. Yes, I am a Christian." Can I encourage us, though, again this Christmas to listen to the pigeons, if I might put it like that? The pigeons that provide us with proof of the truth of this account. The pigeons that show us a promise fulfilled. The pigeons that show us the poverty of Jesus' birth. Let's listen to the pigeons, and let's listen to the people too. The people who recognised this was God's promise fulfilled, that here is the one whom God has sent to save each one of us. Listen to the pigeons, listen to the people, and welcome the one who came to save you and me.